Okay, today is Monday, February 5th, 2018. And we're talking about a simcha, Baruch Hashem, another great grandson. It's a great simcha. But unfortunately, there's another part of life, and I want to dedicate the shiur in memory of Mrs. Esther Zuroff. And that's a great deal of Yeshiva University's history. It brings back endless memories. She was Dean Zah's daughter. Dean Zah had two children, a son and a daughter. Very wonderful children. His son, Dr. Krauss, was a doctor, and he was the doctor for all the yeshiva students. He was the doctor for the dormitories, and a wonderful human being. Esther was very special. She was, in the early years of Stern College, a very dominant figure. She was like what we would call today Dean of Students. And if you knew her, she was perfect. That's the perfect description of her. A woman with insight, with warmth, with understanding, a motherly figure. There was so much to her. Her husband was the principal, a founding principal of BTA, Brooklyn Talmudical Academy. That's Rabbi Abraham Zuroff, who died also, Yitzchak, how long ago? Within the year, am I right or wrong? It's not ancient history. And they were a wonderful, wonderful couple. Among their children, they have a very famous son, Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, who is the Nazi hunter for Wiesenthal and did his doctorate in Bar Hatzalah, and has done some wonderful achievements in bringing Nazis to justice. I also want to mention, I'm very happy that I'm not alone in the world. Sometimes I yell, I shout, I complain, and I wonder, am I seeing it right? So I think you recall that I mentioned a week or two ago that we have a great, great, great disgrace in the name of Frumkeit, Mishpacha, Ami, they don't publish pictures of women. So, and I told you, it leaves the impression that every man is a sex predator and every woman is a sex siren. I mean, is this the way we want to raise our children? And people cannot have a normal attitude. So I have to tell you, refuting Mishpacha's fake history claim, Dr. Leslie Ginspark Klein, a writer and speaker, a woman wearing a shetel, a pious lady, she's in the Rakefet Hall of Fame. She called Mishpacha to order. With, you know what's happened? It's now an international scandal that they blocked out, you can call it Rakefet, they blocked out Hillary Clinton's picture. That's one. Then they blocked out the Chofetz Chaim's wife's face. I mean, it's beyond comprehension that Jews who think they know what Torah is about. So now they blocked out women in the Holocaust. Could you imagine the women being led to their death? So there evidently is an outcry. So Mishpacha followed the art scroll tradition of absolutely total outright lies. The Torah says, Midvashecha Sheka Tirchok, and they, Dvashecha Tikrav. And she caught them. What a piece of work. So they sent out to anyone who complained, they sent an email. Mishpacha magazine abides by the policy set in place by prominent Torah leaders of 70 years ago, which include not publishing photos of women. She collected endless photos of women that appeared in Agudah publications. Even before, she has some Jewish Observer, but even before Jewish Observer, Kala Kavod to this woman, she enters the Rakefet Hall of Fame. More and more and more pictures. It's all over the world now. It's like the internet. You breathe on the internet, and the whole world will tell you Gesundheit, you understand? Here, what she did here, what she showed. And I quote her words, she speaks better. I didn't say it as nicely. I have spoken elsewhere at length on the damage erasing women is doing to the community. Very briefly, In the absence of images of modest women, the only images of women that boys and girls see are those of the secular media, which are oftentimes inappropriate by orthodox standards. From an educational perspective, boys and girls need positive images to counteract the negative images they absorb from the media, and girls need modest roles to emulate. However, there are none. Instead, there is a policy that hypersexualizes women and girls, suggesting that even their faces are obscene. Instead of absorbing the messages of images of couples and families that reflect the normal, from healthy lifestyle, our children read books and see advertisements that show Shabbat tables with no mothers or sisters. This reality is damaging the spiritual health of the community and making it significantly harder to properly teach the concept of a healthy tznius and body image to girls and boys. Additionally, erasing women contributes to the mistaken perception that women in Orthodoxy are second-class citizens who should not be seen are excluded from the public sphere. It leads to a feeling of disenfranchisement in from women and girls. It's problematic enough that Mishpacha and the like are erasing women from the present, but now they seem to be erasing women from the past as well. However, Mishpacha's above claim fails the most rudimentary tests of historical accuracy. And this is intellectual dishonesty that destroys a human being, destroys Torah, destroys your relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. I don't know. It's on the internet here. Let the whole world see it. Where'd she publish it? I'm sure she did, 100%. Look it up. Go on to the internet. I don't want to say. Her name? Dr. Leslie Ginspark, G-I-N-S-P-A-R-G, Klein. And she has taught at Touro College and Hebrew Theological College that's in Chicago. She has a PhD in Education and Jewish Studies from New York University. She is alumna of the Wexner Graduate Fellowship and a recipient of the 2009 New York's Jewish Week's 36 Under 36 Award. And it goes on. Evidently a great woman, and I'm happy that I'm not alone in this world and my mind thinks in a Torah fashion. Baruch Hashem. Okay, today is, so we're ending out to so many weeks of Hakarat HaTov. But let me pick up in a way that you'll be able to follow me without a problem. We spoke yesterday about the classroom, about the Rav as an outstanding teacher, his methods. He was one of a kind. On the other hand, it's well known, it's nothing that can be hidden. It appears in the documentary on the Rav. It appears in memoir literature on the Rav. It appears on the eulogies on the Rav. And it certainly is well known to anyone who sat in the Rav Shir in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, not the 70s. And that was the tension in the class, that the Rav could come down very hard on a student who it didn't measure up to his standards. Even though many a time the Rav later would apologize and change the whole Shir, you were right, I was wrong. And it's, there's a question here. On a personal level, the Rav was a very fine, warm individual. We told stories yesterday, two of the stories. Vic Geller told one story, I told another story. Certainly my story is classic with the elevator and holding the door afterwards. And Rabbi Rubin, who's living testimony, who grew up in Boston and Brookline. And the Rav was a different person in Brooklyn, in Brookline, and a different person in New York, certainly during the golden years of the Rav's activities. And of course, the question comes up, Why was this? All right, he demanded a lot from his students. And yet, if you look at the Rav, if you view the Rav, if you knew the Rav, somehow students wanted to love him, but he had difficulty in feeling, in accepting. And Vic Yella, who, if you knew Vic Yella, very, very insightful individual. I want to quote from the volume that I quoted from yesterday, Orthodoxy Awakens, beginning on page 266. And Vic takes the Rav on as a Rebbe and describes him. The Rav's classroom was, however, more than a setting for the intellect. Like all classrooms, it also housed emotions, the constant flow of sensibilities between teacher and students. In the realm of the mind, Rabbi Soloveitchik epitomized mastery. In the more subtle arena of feeling, he was beset by mystery. And mastery, mystery. When Vic goes into an analysis here, which I have to agree with, I humbly think he's correct. The Brisker dynasty, there was a certain coldness to it. In Brisk, everything was learning. It was epitomized by Reb Velvel, and all of you know, it is said that Reb Velvel never sold. Now just think about that. That's his own Talmidim, his own family. Anyone who knew him, there's one picture of Reb Velvel in Switzerland where he has half a smile on his face. And they say what had happened was he went to Switzerland in the early years of the State of Israel, and it was for medical reasons. And he stayed by a very prominent, wonderful family, Yateg Neman. Occasionally writes the family up. It was a Swiss family from 100% Machnisei Orech, and the lady of the house didn't know what to do, Rav Velvel, Brisker Rav. And before he left, she asked if she could take a picture of him. And in that picture, he smiled because he felt he owed her thanks for how kind she had been. I remember talking with Rabbi Ruchem Gerelich. Rabbi Ruchem was a very fascinating individual. There were areas he was black and white at the same time. He was heat and cold at the same time. Interesting individual. And one time, in a moment of candor, he made a very similar comment about his Rebbe. There was a certain, a certain fear combined with, if like we said yesterday, Reb Chaim couldn't handle death. The only time he could handle death is when he realized this was an ish halacha that Rav writes about, when he realized that even in death there's halacha, then he could start to comprehend death. The halacha won out. It was had to cover everything. And this is what Vic says. As a part of the Soloveitchik dynasty, perhaps, it was to be expected. The Torah of Brisk was strong, not soft. Its application left the Rav hungry for the love of the students, a love they proffered, but which until his later years he could not feel. The tradition of his father, Rav Moshe, was the austere pursuit of intellectual excellence. In Brisk, the transmission of Torah was mind to mind. Demonstrations of affection were distractions that compromised the quality of the scholarly transfer. This was especially true when Reb Moshe found himself confronted by the genius of his eldest son. And here I will prove it correct with two major sources, one that you can all consult, and one that only these ears and eyes can reveal to you. Here's Reb Moshe, the son of Reb Chaim, the grandson of the Beit HaLevi. People have different characters, different personalities. The Beit HaLevi was very strict, rarely smiled. Also, Torah. Very worried, was he mekayim the halacha properly? The stories are told that the Seder with the Shemurim, the Netziv once described the difference between himself and his mechutin, the Beit HaLevi, that the Beit HaLevi was always worried he didn't do it to the end. And the Netziv was a very happy person. You went to the Seder of the Netziv, there were no shilas, no doubts. Everything was done with joy. You went to the Seder of the Beit HaLevi, did we have, was the Mara enough? Was Hapsar enough? Was the Korech enough? Was the Afikomen enough? Were the Dalit Kaisat enough? So different personalities here. Reb Chaim, while he inherited the Beit HaLevi and went beyond it in learning and Chiddush and insight, his whole world was Torah, nothing beyond, but he was a very different personality, much more relaxed. The stories are legendary. The Rav would talk about them. Rakefet wrote them up. The kids were playing cups and robbers, tying the robber to the tree. Reb Chaim says, tie me to the tree. No kid wanted to be tied. Then the kids got tired. They ran home to get a drink. And Reb Chaim's gabbai finds Reb Chaim tied to the tree. I give you the source, go into the rab. See, that was Reb Chaim. Reb Moshe already was a lot more serious, austere in his attitude, more like the Beit HaLevi. And here he has a son, an absolute genius. The Rav was the Rav, no two ways about it. And his second son, who came 2 years after the Rav, was Rav Shmuel. So Rav Shmuel told me, and he went on to become a PhD in chemistry. He was not stupid. Patents in production of oil in the 1930s. He was a very bright individual. But Rav Shmuel told me, I had the skud, I learned with all three Soloveitchik children. I was very close to Rav Shmuel. He and his wife, Bathsheba, Zichronim, Tzadikim Levracha, made a Sheva Brachas for Malka and myself when we got married in 1960. So Rav Shmuel told me, when we were little kids, so our father was teaching us, Rav Moshe, and he would say, do you understand? And he would, the Rav, and the Rav would say no. And he would say to the Rav, and the Rav couldn't tell it over properly. And Rav Moshe would get angry at him and yell at him and rebuke him. But the Rav came back again. He said, I didn't want my father to get upset with me. I didn't want my father to yell at me. My father asked me if I understood. I said, yes. And that's why I'm in a marriage and my brother is the Gadol Hador. So see, this is, Vic Geller is not wrong here. But if you don't believe what I heard with my own two ears, all right, you don't have to believe it. Go and open up Shulamit Meiselman's volume, The Soloveitchik Heritage, or The Soloveitchik Legacy. What's it called? The Soloveitchik Heritage, I believe. There's only one volume, we can't miss it. Shulamit Soloveitchik Meiselman, Soloveitchik Heritage, I believe it's called, published by Ktav. And you'll see in that volume, she describes the relationship between her father and her brothers. And I think if you read between the lines, if you have a degree, if you're going to be a psychologist, a PhD, a psychiatrist, it's an MD specializing, you don't have to be a psychiatrist to see between the lines. She's upset with her father that he came down too hard on her brothers. And her father never appreciated Reb Shmuel because he was in the one like the Rav who would fight back and teach me, and I have to understand it, and I have to get to the very end, and the father would be upset with him, but he would continue. Rav Shmuel wanted to avoid all that difficulty, so he did not have the same relationship with her father. And she says it in the volume, exactly what Vic Geller, he doesn't quote her. The volumes were written approximately the same time. It could very well be that Vic did not have access to the Meiselman memoir. And here he says it. To Reb Moshe felt the full realization of his son's potential was his primary responsibility. To do so, he relied more on the stick than on the carrot. A good explanation of a piece of Gemara which had been sufficient for other students was not acceptable from Reb Yosef Dov. He insisted his father had to be better. The reward for excellence was the demand for greater excellence. The more the pressure, the better the results. The love, admiration, and approval that the father felt for his son was a private treasure that he tucked away in his heart. It did not have to be displayed to be cherished. These are fabulous words by Vic. And the truth of the matter is, the Rav said this very concept many, many times in public, that the affection is like the Beis Hamikdash, like the Aron HaKodesh. It has to be covered by a parochat. It's not something you show in public. It has been noted that the Rav, in describing his relationship to his father, said many times, and see, this is amazing about the Rav, a very private person, but in front of 3,000, 4,000 people, 10,000 people, in a shir, he could reveal his most inner thoughts. And the Rav described many times that his father, Reb Moshe, never kissed him. He always knew that his stern father and mentor was his staunchest champion, but his father never kissed him. And I have to tell you, now in retrospect, I understand my own life story. I told you, and here it came up again at the surprise banquet they made in my honor, I'll call it, and Reb Heschel spoke. So you see, here I speak before my marriage. I remember 22 minutes, I gave a whole shiur on the Mesachek B'Kuvya. Why did I speak in that topic? That was a topic we were learning with the Rav, and the Rav had opened our minds, and could also be I spoke on the topic not realizing that marriage is a course of the a throw of the dice. You follow Mesachek B'Kuvya, you never know how it's going to work out, particularly today in the year 2019 with so much divorce. It's unbelievable that it truly is Mesachek B'Kuvya. So when I finished, the Rav embraced me and kissed me. No, I didn't pay any attention. Fine, I spoke, thank God, successful. The picture in Washington, you see the Rav reading my notes as I'm speaking. He's looking over my shoulder, look at the picture. And then Mr. Abram sends me during Sheva Brachas, I told you the story. I said, what did I do? What did Mr. Abram's do? Dean of the yeshiva, I come in, you know, b'techilu b'rechimu, and he says, Arnold, for I saw at your wedding, I never saw, I told Rabbi Belkin about it, and we agreed you will be the next Rosh Yeshiva when we have an opening. I said, what did you see? He says, Rabbi Soloveitchik kissed you. And I have to say, the yeshiva kept its word. The next opening for Rosh Yeshiva, 1 year later, I get a telegram. That was the communication then. I have the Rabbi Belkin wants to see me. I remember I got it on Thursday. I had to be at the yeshiva 10 o'clock Monday morning. And, you know, I was in Philadelphia, suburb, big trip, Pennsylvania Railroad. All right, and there I come into Mr. Abrams. And he takes me right away to Rabbi Belkin, who was next door, the office. And That morning I drank l'chaim with Rabbi Belkin and Mechpenach Memana, Rosh Yeshiva, and Yeshivas with Kolchanan, and Chul V'chul went with it. But when you put it into context, you can start to understand where it's coming from. And the Rav, you see, if there was a feeling of love, that the Talmidim love the Rebbe, and the Rebbe loves the Talmidim, and that's expressed, well, there wouldn't be the feeling of awe in the 40s into the 50s, into the 60s, mid-60s. That feeling of awe dominated the classroom. And then what happened, and this comes across in the documentary, and then what happened was the Rav, unfortunately, realized he's immortal. When you are close to death, the operation, he recovers, was miraculous. Then his wife, and tragic, you know, the Rav spoke about it. If you recall the talk he gave at RCA, he said, I'm not a mystic, but that Yom Kippur, when they were taking the Torahs out of the Aron Kodesh, to walk around, one of the Torahs fell in the Aron Kodesh. And the Rav said, when I saw that Torah fall, I knew my wife would not survive the year. And you see the impression it left. And from that point on, basically, it's a different Rebbe. He recognizes not everyone is a genius. Not everyone can think on the highest level. Not everyone can say chidushim that would be overwhelming and brisk. And it's a totally different attitude that envelops the classroom. And here, the 70s, I want to talk about the Rav's relationship with one family. And then I want to open your eyes to some of the most insightful talks the Rav gave in the 70s. The Holzer family became very close to the Rav. A little bit background on the Holzer family. Mrs. Holzer, should live and be well. She came from Slonim Chassidim. Her father came to America, a teenager, grew up in Slonim, made it very big in America. Jewelry, real estate, never forgot his origins. And if you go to the Slonim Yeshiva in Meir Shearim, you'll see that one of the main buildings is dedicated in honor of Dina and Moshe Deichmann. Those were Norma's parents. Wonderful people. Manny, her husband, was a YU Musmach, 50s. He was in the rabbinate at first. Afterwards, he joined his father-in-law in his business endeavors. Now, Manny had one advantage that no one else had. He was able to devote time to the Rav whenever the Rav needed help. The business ventures involved real estate. To take care of property, you can do it on your time. So Manny had one advantage, and here the Rav in the 60s already needs help, someone who can drive him, pick him up at the airport, someone who can record his shiurim. As you see, getting shiurim recorded and today uploaded, the Rebbe is Tully B'chazdei Talmidav. Manny was available full time. More than that, Manny had four children, three boys. Two of the boys became Talmidim and afterwards Gabayim for the Rav, so that there was a very, very warm relationship between the Holzer family and the Rav. One time Manny was driving the Rav to the airport to fly back to Boston, December time, I think if I remember the dates, December 20th, 21st, 1 year, and you'll see why I'm telling you this in a second. And suddenly the snow is on the ground. The next thing you know, all flights are canceled. Here they are in Kew Gardens Hills where the Holzers lived. The Rav in the car, no place to go. man, he says, Rebbe, you'll stay with us until the airport reopens. And for 2 days, the Rav was a guest in the Holza home. We were coming to America. We knew we would be staying somewhat of our trip in the Holza home, and we didn't know what to bring them for a gift, so we had a plaque made here in Israel. The Rav slept here with the exact dates, the 2 nights that the Rav slept in the Holza home, a plaque. So it gives you that. The Holza home in Kew Gardens Hills was open, smachat. The garage was abolished, and that garage was turned into a beautiful room just for smachat. You could fit in 50 people, 55 people, and many sheva brachot in that room. When the Rav attended, obviously he was asked to speak, and here the Rav felt totally at home. And he would let his hair down. See, today, it's a little bit hard to let your hair down because everything is recorded, but not just recorded. You see, with Netanyahu's son, it goes all over the world within minutes. You cannot say off the record anymore because everything is recorded, put on the internet. Before you know it, it is all over the world. In that house, the Rev let his hair down. True, he was being recorded. But Manny, it went to, you know, close friends. Rabbi Albert, it was called, the rabbinate there was called the Queen's Mafia. Why was it called the Queen's Mafia? Does anyone know? Very simple. It was the only rabbinate in the world where everyone got along. There was never machloket in Queens. Rabbi Schoenfeld, Rabbi Albert, Rabbi Holzer, Rabbi Shapiro, Rabbi Sladowski. You can go one by one. They all got along. So that was called the Queen's Mafia. So who got copies of the tape? The Queen's Mafia. And a guy like Rakefet, Manny was beholden to me. I taught his children. He wanted to make to reward me. So Baruch Hashem, I got copies of these talks. These talks, if you want to understand the Rav, they are the most revealing that the Rav ever gave. And you can see already the influence of the 1970s. And let me begin. I'm quoting from volume 2 of the Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. That picture itself, it captures the Rav. He's just said a good vort. Look at the smile on his face. You understand? Torah above everything. And what I'm quoting here, page 241, it's fabulous. This is the Sheva Brachot of David and Rona Holza. Let me just say a few words. The two boys who learned by the Rav, Rabbi David Holza, and then his younger brother, who learned in the Kollel too, Rabbi Doctor, he's a medical doctor, Barry Holzer. He's a psychiatrist. He's a child psychiatrist that practices, as far as I believe, is in Flatbush. And two wonderful young men, both of them married students of mine. And David married Rona Zweig from Philadelphia, and this is their Sheva Brachos. And if you want to know, if I told you the story, cut me off. But it's a Rebbish story on a guy named Aaron Rakefet. And the story is very simple. David was quite a catch, a Talmud Chacham, a Yerei Shemayim, a good mind, a good home, a beautiful family. And he went out with a lot of young ladies, and he didn't know what to do. So he went to the Rebbe. This is a true story, word by word. He went to the Rebbe and said, Rebbe, I've gone out with so many girls. How do I know who I should marry? How do I know when I'll be in love? And the Rav said to him, David, open up a Rambam, Hilchat Shuvah, Perik Yud, Halacha Gimel, and look at that Rambam and you'll have the answer to your question. So David listens to the Rav, figured he's, you know, pushing him off, a Rambam, Hilchat Shuvah. David opens the Rambam and there's the answer, that love of God has to be love of a woman. Knew you've learned Hilchot Teshuvah not. What does love of a woman mean? You can't get her out of your mind. You can't. You think about her. You eat. You sleep. You drink, and she's on your mind. That's the way you know you love a woman. That's the way you have to love God. And then David goes out with this girl from Philadelphia once, twice, and it hits him, and he writes to me. In those days we didn't have instant communication. When you're at the kotel next Friday afternoon, put a kvittel in that this should be my zivik. And my dear friends, that Thursday night David took out Rona. They were up all night talking and talking. A young couple in love, Baruch Hashem. We figured out, I put the kvittel into the kotel exactly at the moment that he proposed to her, and she said yes. That's a Rebbe's story. All right, so now this is at their Sheva Brachas. Listen to this. Here's as well. This is Rebbe speaking, not Rakefet. The relationship of Talmud and Rebbe plays an important role in my life. I have only one son, two daughters, and one son. My son is also my Talmud, and so are my daughters. The basic relationship between me and my children is that of teacher and student, not so much of father and child. I was brought up in an environment where the basic relationship, and this is expressed in my essays, was not the biologically justified relationship of father and son. Sometimes we have in common nothing else but the genetic code. The Torah respected this relationship, which is the common denominator between people. Science calls this relationship the genetic code. However, there is a higher relationship, and that is the kinship of Rebbe and Talmud. The relationship has nothing to do. Have nothing to do with genetic code, because they have. What shall I? Excuse me. Tanakh Nudana, because they have two different genetic codes, but there is, in a certain sense, what shall I say, of identification. When I teach young boys, no matter how complicated the sugya is, I try to pass on to them more than just knowledge. I pass on to them not only the knowledge, the abstractions, and the concepts of the halacha, and also something that I experience, something personal, something intimate, a part of myself. And here, these sentences, the basis, first of all, it's very interesting from the point of view of parent-child. It's not always the best situation that you're always a teacher and not a father. It's best to merge the two, to synthesize the two, to combine the two. But here the Rav lets down, speaks, my relationship, more than the genetic code, it's the teacher. And that relationship is not just with your own children, it's with your students. And you pass on to them, you see, it's not just knowledge, it's beyond knowledge. You're passing on to them yourself, your world, your inheritance, where you come from, what you saw. This is the whole secret of the Masorah. And this is a Rebbe. And listen to what he says. I try to pass this on to all my Talmidim. Some receive it, some accept it. Some cannot accept it because the modern American and European Western man has never known what the relationship between Talmud and Rebbe means. He has never understood Judaism. Perhaps Plato and Socrates understand it. I do not know. Perhaps they understood the relationship between master and disciple. I do not know. However, in Yahadut, this relationship is the Torah Shebal Peh and the great Mesorah. It is the heart of a great tradition which one generation passes on to the next. By passing on this message, the first generation gives itself to the second generation. There is a merger, so to say, an existential merger of the generations throughout the ages and the millennium. And you see, the Rav here, this is the heart of Yiddishkeit, the heart of Torah, the heart of the Litvisha world, the heart of passing on the Mesorah, the heart of Pleitat Sofreihem, the heart of the whole concept of Torah Shabbat Peh. And the Rav says very beautifully, not every Talmud can accept it. In the Western world, there's no concept like this. You go into study with a professor, a famous mathematical professor, 100 people are in the room in Yale, Harvard, wherever it is. He doesn't know the names of the students. He walks in 5 minutes late. He finishes the lecture 10 minutes early. He walks in, he walks out. You barely ever see him again. But in Torah, a Rebbe is a Rebbe. It's a different kinship. And the Rav here is so magnificent. I cannot establish this relationship with every Talmud. Some Talmudim resist it. They look upon me as any other teacher, simply as a technician. I know mathematics, I know chemistry, I know biology. So right, the Rav knows Shas and Paiskim. While they are in class and I explain the sugya, they are pretty good students at times. However, once the Gemara is closed and they are outside the classroom, they do not recognize me. Pretty shocked. However, some Talmudim who have sensitive hearts are, as well as sensitive minds, sustain the relationship between Talmud and Rebbe. Magnificent. Beautiful. The Rav. The reality. And I got to tell you, as a Rebbe of 59 years standing, when I meet a student who says, "Oh, how are you, Rabbi? You were my teacher 40 years ago," at that moment I know I taught this person absolutely nothing. If someone says to me, "Oh, Rebbe, good to see you," all right, I know already I had a better relationship. I have another vort which is not my own. I heard Reb David Lifshitz use it. A Rebbe can say hello, but he never says goodbye. If you say goodbye to the Rebbe, it's a sign, past tense, he's not your Rebbe anymore. But I need not tell you, the Rav then goes on to a description of David and Rona, that he has a sensitive heart, and he has accepted much more than the average student. The Rav can merge with him the generations in Talak. Know what became with the Rona Holzer Zweig family? If I had my way, they'd be living in Yerushalayim, but their brother-in-law, Rona's brother, is the famous Rabbi Zweig, Rabbi, what's his name? Yochanan, I believe, is the first name. He was a Rebbe in Idri, and I think the Yom Kippur War, after the Yom Kippur War, a number of good people left Israel. I don't want to use the word frightened, but perhaps they were. There was a lot to be frightened about, and he wound up in Miami Beach, and the Holzers followed him to Miami Beach. And David is a very interesting individual. He's a chemist with patents, and he issues Svarim, have you Haggadah he issued, and he's Shoinim, and his children help him. Each child plays a different role in the greater Holzer enterprise. A very fascinating, beautiful, beautiful family. That's only part of it. June 15th, 1977. Right in Kew Gardens Hills, and this time a different Sheva Brachas, in honor of the eldest. A year earlier, 2 years earlier. This is Jacob, who was my student in the early 70s, 70, 71 to be exact. the first of the host of children to study with me, Jacob Murray's The Late Cheryl. If you recall, it was a terrible tragedy in Kew Gardens Hills. A dryer blew up. I see people recall you were living there yet.
Of course.
And Cheryl was killed with the little girl, and she was pregnant at the time. Terrible tragedy. Thank God Jacob went further, and Baruch Hashem, a son from a second marriage, just got married a few months ago, a fabulous young man. So, but never what people go through in life. And here's the Rav speaking at their Sheva Brachas. And here you see a reflection of the mellowed Rav, or what I would call the mature Rav. And this has been widely quoted, and here it is word by word. What I have in my work is word by word from the Rav, taken from the tapes. Baruch atah Adonai Melech Haolam she'akol nehyeh b'tzedek. I have the privilege of teaching two of the children of the father of the groom. My relationship with them can be expressed in the following sentence. Quote, they are my pupils and also my pals. And if you're listening to the tape, everyone's laughing. The Rebbe is speaking, my pupils, my pals. Really? We joke together. In the classroom, I become young. When I enter the classroom, my youth returns to me. The other day, I visited the doctor and he examined me. So finally, he asked me, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what's your age? I told him, doctor, it depends where. In your office, 120. In my classroom, 20. This has been widely quoted. This is where it was originally said. And listen to the Rav, you'll hear the slang. I like being around young boys. I become one of the gang. This is the only way to teach. A teacher who does not lose years in the classroom and does not become one of his class cannot teach Torah successfully. You teach pals and friends. You do not teach anything to anyone who is below you. This is my philosophy of teaching Torah. Now, what the Rav says here is crucially important. If you come into class a stuffed shirt, a balgaiva, you might be able to teach a little information, but you're not going to impart the soul of Torah to your students. But if you come into the class without as the Rav says, pals, friends, one of the gang, it breaks down the mechitza, the barriers, and you can teach a lot more than just the technical texts. And this is the Rav. Students as pals, what a sea change. Although I have to tell you, the Rav made an effort, even in the early 40s, the people I interviewed, remember, I yet was privileged to know many of the Talmud of the last classes of Rav Moshe before he died, and subsequently the early classes of the Rav. And they told me during the summer, they would write to Rabbi, he would be in onset, and he would write back. Some of them had postcards they showed me that they got from the Rav in the early 40s. So you see, he made that attempt, but it never succeeded as so successfully, so starkly, as it did in the 1970s. By then already, the Rav recognized this is reality, this is life, and these are my students, and these are my pals. One of the gang. Right in the Holzer Sheva Brachas. I want to quote one more, quote the Rambam as well. Very, very revealing. And this is very moving, because this is already when the Rav is starting to decline. It's the Yache Kala in Boston, August 25th, 1981. It's the conclusion of the Yache Kala, which I spoke about yesterday. The conclusion of the Yache Kala. And Rabbi Schoenfeld, who was then, I believe, president of the RCA or in charge of the education, putting the Achei Kavod together, just made a presentation to the Rav, thanking him for being their Rebbe, for taking the time, for giving Shayurim, and doing everything that the Rav became so famous for. And the Rav now responds to their words. Whether you are indebted to me as your teacher is a separate question, but I certainly am indebted to you as a teacher more than you are indebted to me as my students. It's quite a statement. Do you know why? Because a teacher always acquires more from his students than the students do from the teacher. And here he quotes the Gemara in Tainit, Daf Zayin Omed Aleph, Habe lomadati mi rabotai, ume chaberai yotem mi rabotai, ume talmidai yoter mi kulam. It's a famous Gemara. The Rambam explains it. What does it mean? I learned a lot from my teachers. I learned more from Dibuk Chaverim, which is true. When you have a difficult shaila, a difficult sugi, you want to talk in learning with others. But most of all, from my students. Look up the Rambam, Hilchat Talmud Torah, Perek Hei, Halacha Yud Gimel. HaTalmidim Mosifim Chachma. Chachma Tarav. They add to the Rebbe's understanding. Umachivim libo, and widen his heart of comprehension. Omru chachomim, habei chachma lamadati mechaberai yotemi rabotai mitalmidai yotemi kulam. No, the Rambam evidently is troubled. What does it mean? And he explains, kishem she'etz katan madliket hagadol, kach talmid katan. Mechadet et harav ad sheyotzi mimenu b'sheilotav chachma mefu'arah. That, wow. Take a little match and you can light a tremendous tree with one little match. A Rebbe in the classroom, a Talmud asks a question. Talmud gives some insight. It lights the Rebbe's mind up. And the Rebbe goes further and further and builds more and more, all the result of that Talmud. And the secret of teaching, that the secret of Torah Shabbat. I met so many people in Florida, I can't believe how many Talmidim I have. But you don't know them, you don't see them. All right, a man came yesterday, the doctor who was here yesterday, who's the obstetrician for Satma. Yeah. And he told me, his son told him, you're going to Israel. I've been listening to this Rebbe for years. And his father told me he's now listening 2 years. I met him for the first time for fleeting moments yesterday. But a classroom, there's the interaction. And that interaction, it's not just the questions you ask. It's the eyes. A good Rebbe looks at his Talmidim. He sees eyes. He reads minds. It's inspiring. I know when I ever prepare public talks, I told you yesterday, I just prepared I model HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that they think, Baruch Hashem, that I'm a good Talmud of the Rav. So the Rav's 25th Yard Science, I told you I'm just finished, I have everything Baruch Hashem prepared, and if I have to give more shurim, it's not a problem. I have enough material I could give 100,000 shurim on the Rav, it's not a problem, but I got to get back home for many other reasons. All right, so I prepared the for Shabbos morning in Tinek, in Rabbi Przanski's shul. The afternoon I'm giving a Hartzara lecture in Rabbi Baum's shul. But the Drasha, I have to be honest, I prepared two totally different endings. Which one will I use? I'll see the eyes of the audience. One is a little bit sharp, and one is beautiful, and it's a gashtikel gefilte fish, All right? One is powerful, but it may offend some people. I'll see the audience. I'll read their eyes. Rebbe is so right hand. That Rambam is so powerful. And I told you more than once that Rav spoke about an Adam Gadol. I think Rav Heschel writes it up too. We heard it from Rebbe. He didn't mention the name. My theory is, it's a theory, but I'm 99% certain I'm right. He was talking about the Chazon Ish. And he was talking, and I'll tell you a word of mine on the Chazon Ish. So he's talking about the Chazon Ish. Sometimes he reaches, his conclusions are a little bit strange, mudner in Yiddish. And he says, Favos, if the Chazon Ish, if he would have been a Rebbe in a yeshiva with Talmidim, his Talmidim would have bounced him on a different path. That's exactly this Rambam. And when I came in Aliyah to know the Chazon Ish Kolel and some of the people there, some of them are Americans, the Uru, when I'm talking 49 years ago. So I got to know them, and I noticed that the world always uses the expression a chumra from the Chazon Ish. He's a chumra. They don't say the psak is like the Chazon Ish. If you want to be machmir, but it's not in the mainstream. And that was the Rav, and wow, very powerful. So he's saying to the students, he's saying to the RCA, you owe me thanks, I owe you thanks. And then he goes a step further. Have a different reason why I owe you Yasher Koyach. Many of my shiurim are organized in the classroom. Quite often when I prepare the shiur, I cannot find the right approach. I sit with the Gemara, but it's a difficult sugya. The basic halachic foundations upon which the sugya rests are hard to deal with. Sometimes at night I'm completely in despair. When I come into the classroom and sit down with my students, I suddenly begin to analyze. And he goes on to describe the give and take between himself and the students. And through that give and take, the sugya becomes clear. And the Rav says, I owe you a bigger yashikayach than any thanks you owe me. Very, very moving. But now I want to come to the high point of the shiur. And I guarantee you, Shragai, you will not hear this in most of Baltimore. I say most because there's still little pockets there which go beyond the Rosh Yeshiva of Nei Yisrael today. Little pockets. My dear friends, we have arrived. With all that we've said about the Rav and the Gadlut, the Torah, the individual, the broadness, but there's something that captures him, and everything we spoke about yesterday as well. He had one hero outside of Shas and Paiskim that he constantly referred to, and that was Banshitzvaig. And I want to talk a little bit about Banshitzvaig and quote the Rav talking about him. Yitzchak Leibush Peretz, known as Yitzchak Leib Peretz, Isaac Leibush Peretz, his years 1852-1915, that's 103 years already, essentially like Shalom Aleichem, these were two individuals that captured the world. What's interesting about both Shalom Aleichem and Rabbi Yitzchak Leib Peretz is both of them wrote equally well in two languages, Yiddish and Hebrew. It's very rare. You can be a genius of language. The Rav spoke many languages. The Lubavitcher Rebbe spoke many languages. Rav Herzog spoke many languages. But even though you speak many languages, there's one language where you write better than any other language. That's generally the way it goes. I can speak three languages, but my English is infinitely better than any other language. These two individuals were equally great in Yiddish and in Hebrew, and many of their works were written originally in Hebrew, then Yiddish, then Hebrew. All right, Peretz was a very interesting individual. On one hand, he was a realist. On the one hand, he was a romanticist. He had a smicha from one of the rabbinic schools. Very fascinating individual. His short story, Buncha Schweig, Buncha the Silent, Buncha is the name, Schweig meint machina Schweig, to be silent, is the story of an extremely meek and modest man, downtrodden on earth, but exalted in heaven for his modesty, who offered any heavenly reward, chooses one as modest as the way he has lived. And this is a beautiful story that essentially describes the story. I'll quote the story to you. Buncha the Silent, English translation, Yitzchak Leib Peretz, and it describes, here in earth, the death of Buncha the Silent made no impression. And you can read, you can pick up Peretz. I got this off the internet, so you can get it off the internet. And the guy was evidently a little bit challenged, the word in Hebrew, mafager. His life was very simple. It made no difference. He lived, he died, he achieved. What did he do? In silence he was born. In silence he lived. In silence he died. And in an even vaster silence, he was put into the ground. Ah, but in the other world it was not so. No, in paradise the death of Buncha was an overwhelming event. The great trumpet of the Messiah announced through the seven heavens, Buncha the Silent is dead. The most exalted angels with their most imposing wings hurried, flew to tell one another, do you know who has died? Buncha the Silent. And he goes on, how much the heavenly court appreciated a man who was sinful and made no demands and had no evil in his heart and never fought with anyone. And they say to him, what do you want? Everything is yours. We want to reward you. We have nothing in life. We want to give you everything in the world to come. And Buncha can't believe it. Well then, and Buncha smiles for the first time. Well then, what I would like, Your Excellency, is to have every morning for breakfast a hot roll with fresh butter. And this is the story. How many times the Rav quotes this story. How many times the Rav spoke about Buncha Schweig. Let me quote the Rav. I'm quoting now a talk he gave to the Yeshiva University Institute of Mental Health Project. Is there anyone who remembers what that was about? That was in the 58-59. Yeshiva got a big grant. Harvard and Loyola universities. This was big news for Yeshiva University. Right up there with Harvard and Loyola. Harvard Protestant, Loyola Catholic, Yeshiva Jewish. And they were dealing with psychological problems. After World War II, psychology becomes a big major basis of medical science. I don't want to use the word of the world, but you all know it. Ultimately, when we came in Aliyah, there were no psychologists in Hebrew. Today, any religious Jew who's a psychologist can get a job in the Mamlach Didati school system. They're hunting for psychologists. So the Rav is speaking, and this is Rebbe, word by word. By the way, this is in English, obviously, not in Yiddish. How I got these reels is a story unto itself. It goes back to Rabbi Lamb's uncle, Rabbi Baumel, who had evidently surreptitiously made recordings of the Rav speaking was a big event. This has brought prestige to yeshiva, some money. Isaac Leib Peretz wrote a short story which was later translated into many languages.
When was the date of this?
January 5th, 1959. The story is called Buncher Zweig. Buncher is a name, and Zweig means silent one in Yiddish. And here the Rav says, one had to live in a shtetl of Europe to appreciate a person like Buncher Zweig. In America, I've not seen anyone like him, since such a child would be classified by the agencies as retarded and put away. There are no bunch of slimes walking the streets of American cities. In Europe, where the retarded child remained at home, he could not attend school. If he did, instruction was completely worthless and useless for him. So the retarded child grew up to become the town's idiot or halfwit. He became what we call in Yiddish a shtot meshugana. Sometimes, some individuals were noisy, and other times they were quiet and mute. And then the Rav goes on to describe in the Russian town, he's talking about Haslavich. You can read it, it's in my book. It begins in volume 2, page 89. And he describes, has to be Haslavich. There was a kid like this, about 6 years old. We used to call him, there was a person like this who I knew when I was about 6 years old. We used to call him Out the Moron, the old moron. So what happened to him? And the Rav explains what they did. He inherited a few hundred dollars from his father. The Beit Din, the Rabbanim, took over. They lent the money, and the person paid him a monthly sum for the use of the money. Now, how are you allowed to pay a monthly sum? There might be interest involved. So it was arranged that he would do chores for the person who borrowed the money and utilized it. He would draw water, chop wood, and thus his interest became the payment for the services he rendered. Such individuals were an institution in the small towns in Europe. They were like bunch of like. Without knowing these people, it is hard to appreciate Peretz's story. And then he describes the story, however, after his death, when Bunch arrived in heaven, his status suddenly changed. There, his arrival made a great stir. Throngs of angels preceded him and sang songs of welcome. The heavenly court recounted all that he suffered during his lifetime. He was now the center of attention and equally welcomed into paradise. Buncher could choose any reward he wanted, yet all that he asked for was a hot roll with fresh butter for breakfast every morning. This is the true attitude of Judaism. The greatness and uniqueness of every individual must be stressed. Even Buncher Zweig discharges a prominent role in the divine creation. And here you see, this is Yiddishkeit. He's talking to Jews and non-Jews. He's talking to priests and pastors. But someone simple, deformities, challenged, they have a soul. We have to accept them, part of us. We have to have regard for them. We have to care for them. This was the greatness of the European rabbinical leaders. They were humble, and every Jew could approach them. My grandfather up high in Bristol was a prime example of such deportment. This was also the greatness of the Hasidic movement. Any Jew could approach the Hasidic Rebbeim and feel at home in their courts. Both the great and the simple were welcome. Every individual is unique. This is a basic tenet of Judaism. And I think here you have a message way beyond Buncher Zweig, But what a powerful message, what Yiddishkeit is about, what our roles in life are about, what our attitude should be. And this is coming from someone so great, so beyond us. What a mind, what a background, what blood in his body, what genes, what chromosomes. And yet, my students, my pals, the Jews, my people, humans, human dignity, even the shtut meshugana, human dignity. Yes, Yitzchak. You heard a bunch of
stuff.
What did you say?
It's very moving what you just.
This is the Rav.
I'd just like to share. There were two individuals that I heard in the Gold Shia on Saturday night in Boston when I was, I think, 16, 17 years old. One was Prometheus and the other was Bunce Schreik.
Wow.
But he described Bunce Schreik as representing Av Yisrael,
Yaakov.
The difference between Yaakov and Israel.
Ah.
Of course, on that you know that one is profound and one is simply Yid.
Right.
And he described Yaakov as Bunch of Shvayim. And the first time in my life, I was marveled. Because he was a master of not only Talmud,
Yaakov
of
Yiddish. Yeah, yeah.
And he would talk about Yiddish literature many times.
Right, so
and even Prometheus, which was Greek.
Right, right. And you know that the Yiddishist in Boston would invite the Rav once a year to speak just to hear his Yiddish.
Right,
the Workman's Circle. Okay, I hope I've done credit to my Rebbe. I want to go one step further that I consider very important when we talk about the messages and you talk about Bunch of Swag, I think there's another mess as well. And here you have two examples, two great individuals, and each one was involved in a controversy beyond their control. People live a normal life, people have desires, people have visions. The Lubavitcher Rebbe and the Rav. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, you all know, desperately did not want to be Rebbe. His brother-in-law, Reb Shmaya Gurayeh, the Rashag, and the Rebbe was called the Ramash, Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Ramash. Gurayeh was groomed all his life to inherit his father-in-law. And the Rebbetzin intervened, the sixth Rebbe's widow. We're talking about Nechamadina, Rebbetzin Nechamadina. She was totally in favor of Reb Shmaya Gurayeh. We spoke about it in great length a few years ago. And the Hasidim ruled that Reb Menachem Mendel had to become the Rebbe. And you have to give credit that over the years, Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson, his brother-in-law, Reb Shmaya Gurayeh, became a very, very devoted chassid. And the relationship between them was like silver and gold. You see in all the pictures how the Rashag stood before the Rebbe like any other chassid, but the chilu of Rechibu. He once said a vort that my brother-in-law can go to the kever of our father-in-law and get a message from him. And he said, I can do that too, but I don't understand the message. The Rebbe gets the message and understands the message that is beyond me. Mamish, they worked out a beautiful relationship. Yes, I agree that I don't want to be intellectually dishonest. Rebbe Nechamadina never came around. But all right, that's a mother-in-law and son-in-law relationship which perhaps has universal implications. It shows up, as you recall my lectures, in the whole machlokes of who owned the sperm in the library when the grandson started taking sperm out of the library. With the Rav, I want to tell you, it's not on the same level of two sons-in-law and a mother-in-law, but the Rav had one tremendous dream. I quote members of his family word by word. This was what his life was about. His own children. President of Yeshiva University. successor to my cousin Rabbi Revel. Read Shulamit Meiselman's memoir. She says that killed her father of Moshe, that there was opposition to the Rav. Read the memoir. It's a dream. You can understand it. A young man, America. The rabbinate is wonderful, but not for a person of his abilities. Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel was one of a kind. Rabbi Dr. Joseph Baer Soloveitchik, one of a kind. A dream. And then it got involved. It was Rabbi Young wanted the presidency. And Rav Shmuel Belkin, a youngster, a Rebbe in the yeshiva, a PhD from Brown University, Greek and Latin, teacher in the college. No great yichus. It's not Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. And it was a battle for the presidency. And Rabbi Belkin won out. And here you have two individuals, similar titles, similar capabilities, both rabbi doctors, both geniuses, both elusive. And one won out. And I have to say, they forged a magnificent relationship. Rabbi Belkin was only able to do and accomplish what he did because the Rav stood behind him. And I have to say that the Rav, when you think back, thank God for us that he didn't become president. Where would he be? Shayur. Rabbi Belkin was a great Rebbe. He was the most popular Rebbe in the yeshiva. Rabbi Belkin tried 44, for he continued to say Shayurim. He couldn't continue. By 45, he had to give it up. The demands of the yeshiva university to be, and in 45, they get university status. 45, if I'm off, I'm off by a year, but I think it's 45, not 46. Get university status. The demand, could you imagine the Rav? And then the fundraising. And Rabbi Belkin said to the Rav, I quote, Beryl, your task is to teach, to raise students. My responsibility is to raise the budget. And he totally took the Rav out of fundraising. You have no idea what a gift that was, what fundraising is all about. And even with the yeshiva today, fundraising is the greatest challenge. I noticed the shuls they put me into to speak. Every shul has heavyweight donors for Yeshiva University. You understand? They're not putting me in Ashkaz. They're not putting me in some Favofana Young Israel. And they worked out a beautiful relationship. And this too is very important for us in life, to take the message. As I've boasted many times, I have not had a fight with anyone since 1961. My first shtel, I was 23 years of age, and I had problems. The treif wine, I mean, that's a problem that I still don't have a solution. Vic Geller and I always would meet and talk it over, and what I could have done, but it was in public, there was no solution. What do I do? Breaking out treif wine and it's not Chabad. I can't. Chabad has somehow a way to get over it. People will drive on Shabbos and bring them in. And all right, they have a different approach. It's good for Chabad, but I treif wine in public. It's in private. All right, you can tell the person privately, but here he's breaking out the bottle, but since that time, I have never had a fight with anyone. I've been in institutions, I've been a team player. You take a look at this building and what evolved here. It's my greatest joy. Do I entirely love everything? No, this is the reality. I have to put up with it. What I said yesterday in class, I repeat again. If it would be announced that Rakefet is going to give a public shiur on the Rav, 11 o'clock at night, 25 people will show up, maybe. 11 o'clock at night, the Mashpir is speaking, dancing, singing, Hasidus. Hundreds, 500, still up, chalent, 1:30 in the morning. All right, but I have to face reality. Hasidus is one out. We Litvakim, Rakefet is a dinosaur today. The only question is, what type of dinosaur? I'll ask my grandson to characterize his grandfather. He's a big expert in dinosaurs, Kanain Hara. But I also, what an important message how the Rebbe, Dr. Belkin, and I have to say, this was part of the tragedy, because someone should ask me, but Rebbe, in 1970, they fought when they revised the charter. Yeah, this was the result that the Rebbetzin was not alive, and by 1970, the Rebbe was too friendly with his students. You follow me? They ruled him already, and the students already were kanoia, and they're changing the policy, the yeshiva, and you see in retrospect who was right. I don't know. It's now how many years since 1970? It's on to 50 years, right or wrong. And nothing has changed. All right, I would like the yeshiva to be better and frumer and more learning and more spirit. And it could be more Hasidish. It could be we have to bring in the Mashpir in America. He's doing it. He is in America. And he's doing, I understand, wonders. All right, the more the better. But nothing has changed. There's Talmudical Academy, there's Yeshiva College, there are the graduate schools. And ultimately, everything that happened, the machloket, within months it was forgotten because everyone saw nothing had changed. But that's, in my humble opinion, a comment on the students already and the swing to the right that was part of the scene in the 70s. So this is the Rav, this is his hashpa. I can't say he achieved what the Rebbe achieved, but he never set out to do what the Lubavitcher Rebbe did. The Lubavitcher Rebbe set out that every Jew in the world should be exposed to Yiddishkeit. It's a different concept. I see when every Tuesday I try to wind up in Greg's in Hadar, in Kanyon Hadar, the second floor, and I take the crowd in, and there's this Chabadnik putting tefillin on. I want to say to this guy, you rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, heinous, doofus, depraved, degenerate, the guy, he's putting the tefillin on. Why didn't you go to shul this morning? Why didn't you put tefillin on? All right, I'm a Litvak. I'm going to go plead with you to put on tefillin, you dummy, you stuck moron, you altamoron, whatever you want to call him, you mafagea. Without tefillin, you're a primitive monkey selling phones here in the mall. And I saw the Chabadnik put on the tefillin, his eyes were alive, like the mitzvah he's doing, another Jew putting on tefillin. What the Rebbe accomplished, we have to stand in awe. The Rav, his goal was to raise Talmidim. His goal, to be a Rebbe, to become a Melamed. He found his niche in life, he found his place in life. But look what he accomplished. Kliach Yad, Yeshiva University, the graduates of Yeshiva University, the influence, the frumkeit, holding the line, modern orthodoxy, whatever you want to call it, Torah in Western world, no compromise, mechitza, proper davening. Students did great things. And look in Israel, the best of his students, where did they wind up? Alat Mata Kodesh. And a book one day should be written on what the Rav students accomplished here. You have no idea the impact on the Israeli scene. Shtiller Haid, quietly, Rabbi Lichtenstein, the Hesde Yeshiva. This institution here, what yet can come out of it with proper guidance from New York. Wow. One man, the learning, the knowledge, the approach, the svarim, the books. So Baruch Hashem, neither had total success, but Ajimot HaMashiach, none of us will have total success. That's also a Rav from a vod from the Rav. The Rav said, "V'kol banayich." The prophet says, "Limudei Hashem." All your children. The Rav says, "Until Yemot HaMashiach, halavai we should have Rov Banayach. Okay, so I hope I did a little bit good in memory of the five people who influenced my spiritual gestalt. And if you put it all together, you'll say to me, Rebbe, you described yourself very well. We see the little, the good you got from each individual. Of course, from the Rav, I got more than anyone else. I was mature, I was older, and the relationship with the Rav began as a Talmud in 57, but was ongoing until this very, very moment, as we all understand. My dear students, what did we do today? Well, we pulled together what we alluded to yesterday, the Rav, his Talmidim, letting his hair down, talks off the record. There's a lot more that he said in the Holzer House. That's where he went after the right wing and expressed his discontent with the concept of sameness, same dress, same thinking, same deportment. All our goal is to show I'm as frum as you are. You follow? Quoting the Rav word by word. It's all in my work on the Rav. It all took place in the Holzer House. I think the Rav would agree very heartedly the way we began this year with our critique of Mishpacha magazine and the tragedy that they are engendering among Klal Yisrael, Bnei Yisrael, Torah Yisrael, the Chilul Hashem, Bifnei Am V'Eda, before the New York Times. It's frightening to me. I talk about it, I get upset just thinking about it. My students, on Sunday, it's a different world altogether. Before I get back to Tel's Yeshiva and Kaddish, I want to spend a week or two on Mamzeret. It's come up again on the Israeli scene. If you saw the weekend freebies, and the Rebbetzin who wrote the article on Mamzeret challenging the rabbit happens to be my student from Michlala. It is Charlie Liebman's daughter, Professor Liebman's Zichrona Levracha. This is his daughter, Rivka, who I remember as a little girl in Balakinwood, in Lower Merion, and she's today a well-known Rebbetzin, a husband, the Rav. We're talking near Haifa, and she's challenging. And if you heard what went on this morning on the news, the chief rabbi, Rav Yosef, ripping the heck out of Barak, I couldn't believe my ears, because wait till you see what his father, Rav Ovadia, had to say on the same topic. So I want to get that out of my system, and then we'll return to Tells and Kaddish and all that goes with it. In the Monday class, we're picking up again before World War I, Reb Lazer Silva. I'm going to explain the uniqueness, Reb Lazer, what he said. You won't believe your ears. World War I and the sea change in American, including Torah on the American scene. But next week, no class on Monday for very happy reasons. I'll be zeichel lahachnis another great grandson into the Brit of Avraham Avinu, and ani modeh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, it's not a small matter to be in health and to have such wealth that I have my own minion now. I always had a big minion of grandchildren, and now I have great grandsons. I have my own minion, Baruch Hashem. My dear students, there are a lot of freebies.
When are you going to America?
Forget about America. That's before Pesach. After Purim, there's still two shayurim. Now, if anyone wants a copy of what we gave out last week with the Rub's letter and the Rub's handwriting with Rakefet writing it up, you're welcome to take. Yitzchak was right. It does appear in Natty Helfgott's volume without any comment. And I think our comment on the last paragraph is absolutely true and hits the Rav in his inner soul why the Koldo Dido fake couldn't go in Aliyah. Yes?
Could you make some more copies of the article on the Mishpacha magazine? Because I think you only have one.
I have one. Okay,
I'll send
you send them a link?
Oh, you can be it on screen, no?
You want it? So take this copy.
Yeah, there's other people here. I've got their
business. How many copies do you want? I can make copies, but it's not a problem.
Five or six.
Okay. Yitzchak sent me a link. Yitzchak, you should know I saw this when it was, I commented on it when it was being prepared. So I know this is the OU tshuva of the Rabbanim to the question of women and their role in the synagogue. It's very good, it's very balanced, and the OU adopted it. It's signed off, you'll see. If anyone wants it, you're welcome to it. This is a beautiful article on Putin. Holocaust Day fell on Shabbos. He did not celebrate it on Shabbos out of kavod for the Torah community, but celebrated it on Monday. Very interesting. He's in the museum that I spoke about when I showed you the pictures of our trip to Russia. Fascinating. I'm not crying here. Can Woody Allen work in Hollywood again from the New York Times? Woody Allen's Joy Color Torah Killer Pokes Fun at Yiddishkeit. Take a look. What a maneuver. Leaving out, married to his stepdaughter. But what else? Unbelievable. Will never work again in Hollywood, I think. It's the Me Too generation. This was sent to me by a Talmud listening, O.O. Orbach, he goes by. It's very fascinating stories that we know. For instance, Kennedy, the father, refused to let the Jews into London, and he was cursed, and look what happened to the family. Who cursed him? I've heard many, which rabbi was there of many, many stories. A Japanese ambassador in Lithuania, beyond Semple Sugihara, who was only a consul, an ambassador who was very good and helped the Jews. He got a bracha, and his name was Mitsubishi. Draw your own conclusions. And then about the Ukraine, very interesting. Now, Orthodox Union will not penalize synagogues that already have women clergy. Read the article, see the way the OU is trying to walk between the raindrops and give these synagogues time to change. Here's sad news going on all over the world. Iceland set to ban circumcision. Now, there are not many Jews in Iceland, but if they ban it, they're worried about Belgium, Holland, Amsterdam. Oh, what's going to go on? New Jersey Township, the Mawa Township Council, was a bitter battle over building an Erev. They now, because the courts have intervened, are allowing the Jews to build an Erev. The kid who was murdered, Bernstein, he was killed by a Nazi group in America. Unbelievable. Athletes to watch at the Winter Olympics. We have more Jews than ever in various fields. Can I inherit if these people devote themselves to learning? We have Gedoli Gedoli Israel. Arnold Matulski, a founder of medical genetics, dies at 94, a refugee from Nazi Germany, living in Seattle. Very nice obituary, very interesting. I only have one question. Is geblieben a shtickle Yiddishkeit? Did any Yiddishkeit remain with him? That remains.
I sent you, Waxman wrote a new book on modern Orthodoxy, the Rav's view.
You're talking about Chaim Waxman.
Chaim Waxman.
When did you send it? I didn't see.
I think Thursday.
I didn't see it.
I'll send it again.
Send it to Sherry, because she can print out whatever you want. It's very busy. Very easy. C.B. Levy. Cheryl Boy Levy. C.B. Levy. L.E.V.Y. at Y.U. .edu, education, edu. To my attention, Sherry will know what to do with it. Be very interesting to see who published it. It'd be very interesting, because Chaim Waxman is a sociologist, is a mismach of the yeshiva, and the fact that son of David Lifshitz is an added icing on the cake, but he's a wonderful individual. Be very interesting to see. My dear students, so let us remember next Sunday class as usual. Monday I'll have to figure out a way to get up to Zichron Yaakov. I got to find out where the Brit is. I'll should be Mazel Dick. And I want to thank you for coming and helping the Rebbe, a small match, kindle a big fire. I hope I've been successful. It means a lot to me to do homage to my Rebbe, Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, and to remember the memory of Mrs. Esther Zuroff, what can I tell you? It's a world gone by, but the obligation is to take it further, and the future worlds of Jewish Judaism, Jewish people, should be in the spirit of Torah and Yirat Shemayim, Lekavod Ulatiferet, and until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'Danya.